All right. Well, go ahead and get the rest of the morning program going. As a reminder, any questions you have for the speakers, please write them down. We'll collect them towards the end, and then we'll have our Q&A session before lunch. Again, lunch will be served in the patio, and we'll help direct you where that is. You'll need a ticket for lunch, so if you don't have one, please see Kathy, and she can fix you up. All right, to start the second half of the morning session, our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Johnson. Dr. Johnson is our program director at the Phoenix Integrated Surgical Residency. He's been with us for a couple of years. Before that time, he was at Shock Trauma in Maryland. He, like all of our speakers, is basically world-renowned with publications in multiple peer-reviewed journals. His passions are in trauma, acute care surgery, as well as critical care, and of course, probably one of his bigger passions is surgical education. He's going to be speaking to us this morning on the training of the general surgeon. I think the training of a general surgeon is of interest to all of us. Many of us are not involved with surgical training, but most of us would like to know that there'll be excellent general surgeons out there. So I'd also like to especially thank Dr. Johnson. Not only was he instrumental in bringing some of the great speakers we have for this symposium here to town, but he's generously volunteered to give this talk to help round out our program. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Johnson. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. King, and as always, you're ever so kind in your introductions and your comments, and I appreciate it. We're going to talk a little bit about something that's different than the typical scientific program, and that is how we go about training, and are we training the future of general surgery correctly, and what can we be doing to look at this whole process and making it better. I have no disclosures other than I care about general surgery and I care about the training of a general surgeon. I get no financial reimbursement, not anywhere close to what I should be getting, yeah, for that activity. When we look at general surgery training, residency training, we're really trying to have two primary goals. We're going to train the end product to either go out and become an autonomous general surgeon in general surgery practice, or we're going to prepare them to be go into postgraduate and fellowship training into the future. That's really basically the two areas that we go into. They both require the development of an autonomous expertise with cognitive knowledge, skills, technical skills, and a professionalism that we all desire in the type of surgeon who takes care of one of our family members. The American Board of Surgery defines general surgery as a broad, comprehensive management of a number of different categories and content areas, including elementary tract, abdomen, breast, endocrine, organ transplantation, pediatric surgery, surgical critical care, oncology, trauma, burns, vascular surgery. And this is what we are considered to be in our scope of practice as we go forward. We are also expected to have aspects of technical proficiency in all these areas, clinical knowledge, knowledge of the scientific foundations, and experience and skill in a number of the different areas. And so that's what we are supposed to be training towards. We need to be training this group of people because the general surgeon overall is becoming less and less prominent and less are we out there. And it is now recognized to be one of the needed areas going forward, that the general surgeon is a dying breed, if you will, and that the decrease is significant. Over the past 25 years, we've seen almost a 25% reduction overall. And so this is mainly hitting the rural surgery areas, the inner city areas, and the part of it is related to a changing demographic also of the general surgeon to becoming older, and we're seeing more women joining the workforce. There will be, and people argue there already is, a significant shortfall of general surgeons. So we need to be training these people, training these residents to become general surgeons overall. While this is going on, we're also seeing a significant change in the number of residents that are general surgery residents that are going into fellowships. At this point, 80% of our graduating general surgery residents are pursuing fellowship training. That's significantly up over the past 20 years. And you can see that it is affecting not only the university programs, but also the community programs are seeing this change, such that back in the early 90s, we had only 60% of people in community programs going into fellowships. Now it's equal between university and community programs. We're a little bit blessed down here in the Southwest that we have the lowest number going into fellowship across the country. But there clearly is a trend that there's fellowship training. And why is this happening? Because most residents perceive it's an advantageous thing to go into fellowship training. Most of them believe that they have to be, if they're going to be successful, they have to have some type of fellowship training. I'll challenge that. Most of them believe that to be competitive in the market, they have to have a fellowship. That they want to have a better lifestyle, they have to have a fellowship. And if they want to have more money, they have to have a fellowship. But one of the things that's not talked about as much as it needs to be is there's a significant number of residents that get done with the program and say, I'm not ready. I do not feel I can take care of a patient well enough, and I need further training to focus my area and not be able to go out and be concerned. That has gotten to such a point now that the American College of Surgeons has created a program called the Transition to Practice Program that is, in essence, fellowship for general surgeons to do another year to get ready to go into practice. And with that aspect, I think that is probably the most damning signal that we're seeing, is that the American College of Surgeons feels like they have to develop a new program to allow general surgery residents who are board eligible, ready to go out, who are supposed to be trained, in order to just go out and become a general surgeon. Now, as we start looking further, I'll contend that the best training for a general surgery resident, whether you're going into private practice or whether you're going into fellowship, is to be well-trained in general surgery. I had the opportunity before coming here to be a fellowship director at the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center, widely regarded as one of the busiest trauma centers in North America. We trained 8 general surgery residents a year in trauma and critical care. I got them from all over the country. And I can tell you the variability in the product that we got coming out of residency was phenomenally variable, such that I would get some residents from very well-known programs who would get to us, and we'd have to spend the first quarter of their residency, of their fellowship, just training them how to be a good general surgeon. Then we could concentrate on the specialty of trauma critical care. Other programs were very good. We could start right from the very beginning and training them in trauma critical care, what they came to us for. And that is the reason why I truly believe that what we need to be doing is training a fundamentally sound general surgeon in our training programs. I'm not alone in that thought. This is a survey done of fellowship directors and the fellowship council and asking them, what do you think about your general surgery residents coming to your fellows? 1/5 of the fellows, they felt, were unprepared to come to the operating room. 1/4 didn't recognize the signs of a complication. 30% felt that they could not, that their fellows coming to them after completion of their general surgery training could not independently do a lap chole. 2/3 of them felt like they could not leave their fellow alone in the operating room unsupervised for more than 30 minutes in a major case. This is what we're training now, and this is what's going in. 80% of our residents are doing these fellowships, and this is what the fellowship directors believe is what we're sending them. Let's look at it, how well we're training folks. Our residents are doing less than we think they are. SCORE, for those people who are not familiar with SCORE, it's the curriculum that has been developed, surgery curriculum developed by the American Board of Surgery, the Association for Program Directors in Surgery, the American College of Surgeons, and SAGES. It's a comprehensive program. It is what the board feels is essential knowledge and for the curriculum of it, and it defines those essential and complex cases. And when you look at the 121 key general surgery cases and what our residents are completing at the end, only 18 of those cases out of the 121, have they done more than 10 on average? And 63 of them out of the 100, so nearly half of them, the mode or the most common number of cases they did for half the essential cases was zero. We're not training our residents in the caseload that we need them to be, what we consider to be essential. And it's showing up on the American Board of Surgery exam. When you look at the first-time pass rate of general surgery residents on the American Board of Surgery, 20% of the residency programs have less than 60% of their residents passing the written and oral boards on the first attempt. Pretty damning if we say that's our metric for saying that we're training somebody that's worthwhile in our residency program, that that's indeed what it is. Now, there's a number of factors that are playing into the sandstone that's coming across our environment. Things that are changing out there, things that are making us have to do things differently that we have to be paying attention to. You can't ignore the fact that compared to the way most of us were trained, the 80-hour work week has significantly altered. So much so that right now the American Board of Surgery is considering how to get back that extra time. For some residents, that may mean doing 6 years mandatory along the way. Think about that. How to get back that time we lost in the 80-hour work week. The new technology that's coming along. I will say that when I look at my training, my most common operation was a cholecystectomy. Every one of them was open. Within 10 years, I'd done more laparoscopic cholecystectomies than I ever did open. The change in technology has been significant. And then I'll also contend that the surgical diseases are changing, and we'll talk about how we do this. Let's talk about impact of work hour restrictions. They began in 2013. They got revised, especially for first-year residents, such that now autonomy of a first-year resident is almost non-existent. That there, the times when we used to think, oh, God, how am I going to take care of this patient? And it would really make us think, now we have residents who don't have to think, they just have to ask their senior along the way. Now, this ended up losing almost a year's worth of training when you look at it compared to other what we used to have. And the largest impact is on nights and weekends. The times when things that go bump in the night occur that you don't have time to prepare, that you got to know how to handle it, you don't have time to look it up, they're coming at you quickly. And when you look at that, we're seeing almost 50% decrease in the trauma experience overall in many places. There's a variety of reasons for that. And it's also the lack of ability to observe a condition evolve. How many times did we used to sit at a bedside and watch what happened to a patient and develop, and we would help us learn more about that patient's condition? 18 hours later, we could see what was going on, or 36 hours. I'm not saying that that's good, but we've lost that component. When you look at the impact of work hour restrictions on resident education, you see some mixed results. This is a meta-analysis of 56 studies. About two-thirds of them thought that the impact was at least neutral and probably positive. Every study that's looked at ABSAIT scores and training exam scores has found it to be a positive impact. The residents are doing better. Don't ask me how that's happening on a test that is done on a curve, but every one of them seems to impact. And the operative cases has been variable, about 50-50 positive versus negative on that. In terms of resident well-being, every study shows that there's a positive outcome. I can tell you from a program director's standpoint, the biggest impact on resident well-being and resident issues that the work hour restrictions has is I don't get as many calls from the nurses about some resident blowing up at them. There's a reduction in the number of complaints about residents along the way. It's had no impact on the voluntary attrition rate of 20% from general surgery along the way. What about faculty? Not one study has shown a positive outcome or impact on the faculty. In fact, every study shows a negative impact, whether it's the faculty workload and work hours increasing, the decreased time available for teaching. What we're supposed to be fixing, we've now hurt. Increase in job dissatisfaction. And the faculty perception on the resident training is significantly worse. Now, the comment was made that, well, we may or may not have an impact on operative cases. This is the case logs administered to the American Board of Surgery for qualifying to take the written exam. And you can see the implementation in 2003 had an impact, especially on those residents graduating 2 years later. We've seen it come back a little bit. It's coming close to what it used to be, but I'll challenge you that 900 cases over 5 years for training a general surgeon is probably not enough. What about an impact on the board exam rate? Well, now with the, if we look at 2004, the first time they'll be able to take the written exam, you can see it's pretty constant on the written exam. Their cognitive, at least book knowledge, is staying constant. But we've seen the fail rate go from 16% on the oral exam to now where it's sitting up in the low 20s. They're not passing the part of the exam in which they have to know how to apply what they know to taking care of a patient. So the 80-hour work week has some impacts. We can change things around. We can make it longer. We can give them a choice of 80 hours over 5 years, or maybe it's going to be 40 hours over 10 years, and maybe it's 20 hours a week over 20 years. What about the impact of advances in technology? Minimally invasive surgery, I already mentioned. The changes there have been great for patients. The changes there have been tremendous for healthcare. But it's very clear that we now have to train residents not only in open procedures, but also the laparoscopic. And that has impacted our ability to train them properly. Endovascular has radically changed so much that open AAAs are almost becoming non-existent in a resident education, except in those cases in which there's a free rupture, hemodynamically compromised, and even some of those are being done endovascular. They're talking now that for vascular fellowships, maybe they should have a subspecialty of open AAA or open aortic cases that the vascular surgery fellowship could then super concentrate into. It's a changing world, and we need to be able to keep up and teach that. ERCP has completely changed the management of common bile duct stones. Robotic surgery is out there changing things. And the electronic medical record, let's face it, it has not made us more efficient. The bedside provider is not benefited by the EMR. It has slowed us up. Changing surgical diseases. I used to operate on a whole bunch of gastric and duodenal ulcers, and it was a hypersecretion issue that we were looking at, H. pylori coming in there at a time. But now the most common gastric procedures that residents are doing have nothing to do with acid secretion and everything to do with obesity physiology. We're still training our residents to talk about gastrin. We're not teaching them what the details are of ghrelin, which is the primary gastric hormone for obesity. We've non-operative trauma management has changed the number of trauma cases going on. You ask a resident now how many open common bile duct explorations they have done. It's less than two across the country. They're not doing them anymore at all. It's ERCP. They're attempting to do them laparoscopically. And so one of the things that we stress in our residency in M&M or anytime we get a chance is how do you manage common bile duct stones? We have to keep that teaching out there because they will run into it, and we've got to deal. And breast cancer management changes almost daily. And there's no way I can keep up with it. And bless people like Pat McGrath, who's just a superstar, and he knows how to manage all that. But it's constantly changing. So what can we do? We have to have our general surgery residencies evolving to address these issues. A favorite quote of mine came from a famous animal, T-Rex. You got to evolve or become extinct, because that's what's going to happen. We have to evolve ourselves to become better general surgery trainers and teachers along the way. And our goal has to be the development of autonomous expertise at the completion of training in an efficient, effective, and safe manner, and focus on how we can do this objectively that defines professionalism and performance. One of the ways we're doing now, and it's just got implemented in July of this past year, was the development of general surgery milestones required by the American Board of Surgery. And this is where we objectively measure on the six competencies that we think are important in our general surgery residents, how they're doing, and provide them the feedback along the way. We end up having milestones that look like this. This is two of them as they relate to competencies of patient care. Interestingly, there is not a milestone in surgery on the technical skills assessment. That's done in a different way, and we need to be bringing that into these milestones. But these are objective measures that allow the faculty to evaluate the resident on a scale of essentially 0 to 4, and looking at them, giving them this plot of how their patient care is, how their medical knowledge is, how they're able to practice in a system, problem-based learning and improvement, professionalism, and interpersonal skills. And you can see that based on the judgment of the faculty, you can very clearly see where a resident is doing well. This one's doing very well in professionalism, resident number two. And this one, not so well. And so we can then objectively show this to the residents, say, this is what the faculty think you're doing. And then we can also get them to assess themselves. And you can see the differences between how a resident's doing, how an attending's doing. Objectives measure how a faculty think that a resident is doing. This resident, in red here, is their self-assessment. Thinks a little bit higher than themselves. A little bit of an ego here compared to what the faculty think. But we're then able to key in of helping the resident learn what they need to be focusing on. And we need to then also be looking at how well they develop their technical skills and the cognitive abilities in an objective manner that then are the key aspects that we want to impart on residents. And as we look at development of their expertise from a technical standpoint, we realize that there is task-specific. There's some crossover, cross-training, but it tends to be task-specific. Just because you're good at an open case doesn't mean you're going to be good at a laparoscopic case and vice versa. But there are some aspects. The other part that we really need to be concentrating on is it's just not how many cases you do, it's how many cases you do well repetitively. Perfect practice makes perfect. And when we think about our residents and their development, some residents are very, very good early on, and it's because they concentrate better on what are the right steps versus just doing another case. They concentrate, and you think about it, they pick up those steps easier. They pick them up more deliberately, and that's what helps training. We need to get residents that. It's more the practice, the perfect practice, than any innate ability that goes on with training them. Some of that can be done in simulation. In this day and age, simulation training is an anticipated expertise, or at least a component of general surgery training. I think it's very good at helping acquire new skills. Sumit, down here, wouldn't be as good a surgeon if he, right here, wouldn't be as good a surgeon if it wasn't for his simulation training. Maybe he would. He was always a good resident. Brad Oberding, also out in the audience here, and simulation training becomes a key part of moving forward. But really, the training of a surgeon rests on the hollow grounds of the operating room, and it's there where we need to be concentrating and pushing our residents to do more cases, different types of cases, but also more deliberate on their cases along the way. And we need to look at how we, as trainers, how we take them from being very dependent and immature. Wade and Alex, you're still pluripotential cells. We need to get you to differentiate. But as you go forward and as you develop your expertise and your experience and you become like a Vicky, we're able to back off from being very on top of cueing you in to fading away And for Vicki, I'm more saying, tell me what you're thinking. Tell me as you're going forward what you need to be doing. And having her feed to me what needs to be the next steps in an operation. And the idea of queuing versus fading is, I think, a key aspect. Queuing is where we, as the attending, we're showing the resident where to make the cut. We're spreading the tissue and say, Bovi here. They're doing the case they feel like, but they're not doing the mental steps that are needed in taking it through. We're talking to them and directing them more than actually letting them develop their autonomy. And that's where we need to develop the fading components, to back away from the queuing. And one of the hardest things that has of my career that I've come to do is there will be times when I just don't say a thing and step back. And I let the residents start making some of those decisions. And I go, what do you want to do? Where we go next? And I'm challenging them. It's supervision. It is helping them develop. But it's how we develop the expertise going forward and their knowledge going forward that makes them there. And so we need to be able to get our residents such that they know how to operate every time they step into the operating room and how to do it correctly. I strongly believe that M&M is the most important education moment that we have in residencies, that this is truly the golden hour of surgical education, where residents learn how to look at their complications objectively and learn from them in a manner that allows them to at least know what to do in the next one, because they got a complication, untoward event that they didn't want to have, and this is how they learn to say, is there a better way of doing it? And one of the most important things is to say, I did everything right. I would do it all again the same way, but there are complications that happen even if you do everything right. It doesn't mean an untoward event doesn't mean you did something wrong. You got to know when it was the right way to go. What about professionalism? Those values of integrity, honesty, commitment, and empathy that all of us have brought into the field and that we need to be working on developing. In the past, what I'll refer to as the old professionalism, there was always that ownership of the patient and the outcome. The surgeon knew everything about their patient. They did everything for the patient. They didn't leave. They stood by the bedside. Our residents don't see the continuity of the care provided by just one person. And the old doctrine is no longer feasible. The work hours have done it. The increased complexity of patients has taken care of that. In many routine surgeries, I can remember gallbladders being admitted the night before surgery. They'd come in. We'd do them. We'd work them up, you know, do their H&P on Sunday evening for their Monday morning case, and they would be in the hospital for the next 5 days. Our AAAs aren't doing that anymore even. Our big cases are no longer such inpatient cases. So the complexity, the severity of the cases make this old doctrine non-feasible. Today we have to look at maintaining those principles of ownership and continuity of care, something that I think is absolutely essential for residents to learn and be appreciative of. And fortunately, I'm blessed with a whole bunch of residents that believe that and move that forward. But this is something we have to instill in them and be able to show them, that it becomes now team-based care with shared accountability more than an individual accountability, that we have to work in teams to provide this. And so it takes a new set of skills. We just got done working with doing all the interviews for residencies just recently, and one of the key aspects you look for is how well will this person work in a team and how well will they bring the team and make it better along the way. We look for those Michael Jordans who make his teammates better, his or her teammates better, than if they were there by themselves. And with any type of approach to surgical training, you have to look back on how we did things. And I found this quote from Alan Whipple of the pancreatic duodenectomy. And his rules for surgery training, I think, apply today. Always fit the operation to the patient, not the patient to the operation. Be careful, thorough, and meticulous in your operating, but by all means, don't putter. Do not touch tissue unnecessarily, for at best, it is traumatic. Teamwork is your surgeon's best friend, and always be your own most severe critic. And those are principles that apply today. We have a lot of new things we have to bring in to address the issues, but I also think that history helps us in defining some of the basic aspects. So in summary, the goal of general surgery residency training should be to train a great general surgeon. And it doesn't matter whether you're going into private practice or going into fellowship, the training needs to be solid for both. We have room, obviously, to improve. By our own metrics, we have room to improve. That developing expertise needs to be a deliberate process of perfect practice will make perfection. And the challenges can be daunting, but they won't necessarily be insurmountable. Thank you very much.